Hello and welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host in Russian and Eurasian Studies, Philip Velgach. This time around, I'll be speaking to Ivo Meinson to talk about his book called Back to Our Future. Back to Our Future is one book in a series titled The Quest for an Ideal Youth in Putin's Russia. Ivo Meinson decides to focus on an organization called Nasha. Nasha is a political organization made up primarily of Russian youth. This organization builds itself as an independent grassroots movement, though Ivo Meinson carefully shows how this organization is closely tied to the Russian state. Built on the ideology of modernity and patriotism, Nasha is also an organization that commemorates World War II memory within Russian history. To talk about the political spirit in Russia among the youth, we are joined today by Ivo Meinson. Welcome, Ivo.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we delve into the book and into the Nasha organization, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how it is that you came to study Russian history and modern Russian history in particular?
Yes, so I'm actually Swiss, and growing up in Switzerland, of course, I sort of was a witness to the end of the Cold War to a certain extent. And what always fascinated me was, or I thought was really weird, was that we sort of have this notion, you know, living in Western Europe, you still have this idea of this Iron Curtain is still really strong in people's minds. And I remember growing up with that idea and just really realizing at some point after I was done with high school that I knew practically nothing about history, you know, in Eastern Europe, in Russia. And I went to college in the US, and funnily enough, I started taking Russian history classes at college in the United States. I had a really great professor, Abbott Gleason, who was a really great inspiration for that. And after that, I traveled to Russia for the first time, and it was kind of a scary thing because I didn't really know the language very well. I had started learning it a little bit, but I really wanted to go back. But I also realized that if I wanted to go back, I'd have to sort of try a bit harder with the language and with the history. So once I started graduate school, I really decided to go fully into Russian history, and have been there every year since then in Russia, in various places. And it's been really rewarding and really fascinating, because I think it is a field that still today people here know rather little about. So I feel like you can really make some kind of a contribution, and I like that idea.
How did you come to write this particular book? Was there ever a specific inspiration for dealing with youth politics?
I actually majored originally in sociology, and I was really interested in sort of youth organizations in general, and the idea of generations and how knowledge is passed down and how ideologies and political ideas are passed down across generations. And for me, actually, the first impetus to start studying Nashi was that I noticed how present the memory of World War II or the Great Patriotic War still is in Russia today. And when I started hearing about this organization in 2005 that basically mobilizes all these young people through war memory, I just thought that was really fascinating, because I don't think you could do that either in the United States or in Western Europe, and certainly you couldn't do it in Switzerland, because for young people, I think here, you know, in my generation, and even more so in like the generation that's in high school now, that's ancient history, and just nobody would care. And it really gave me, you know, it really made me interested in knowing more about why that is and why that's still such an issue. And I think anybody who has been there to Russia sees that it's, this war memory is still very much on the surface of things, quite in a literal way, but also in a figurative way. And for me, actually, one really important moment was when I was in St. Petersburg, and I went to this battlefield called Nevsky Pyatachok, which is right outside of St. Petersburg. And you walk through it, and you still really see the trenches. You still see the metal. You still find things there. And it's kind of scary, and it's very weird and very different from the way I think that World War II has been dealt with in Western Europe and the United States, where everything is kind of neatly cleaned up, whereas in Russia and in Eastern Europe more generally, these issues are still very political, and perhaps even more political today than they were 10 or 20 years ago. And that was very fascinating to me.
You said that this organization is specifically tied with a shift from Yeltsin to Putin. So I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit of background about this, about what is different about Putin's regime, and then with that go into talking about Nasha, the national organization, and the structure. And you also say that they do not admit to being a state-funded Putin pro-Putin organization, though it is very clear that those connections are there, and they're easy to find as well.
Yeah, I think one of the main reasons, and I'm obviously not by any means the first one to say this, for Putin's popularity is that he came in with this image of being a consolidator. In Russia today, the 1990s, I think, are a great trauma for both the younger generation, which kind of might remember it from childhood, but also especially for older people who really, for them, it was a time when just everything fell apart. And I think we might talk about this a little later, but also if you see, and now things in Crimea and in Ukraine right now, this popularity of Putin has a lot to do with this notion that he is reasserting a kind of a powerful state structure, reconstructing a powerful state structure, which Russia was missing in the 1990s. And this notion of weakness and of being exposed to chaos to a certain extent, but also to Western manipulation, I think is really strong in Russia and really widely distributed. And so when Putin came into power in 2000, or rather 1999, that was one reason why people saw in him like a capable figure, unlike Boris Yeltsin, whom a lot of people sort of in his later years saw as this kind of weak, often not at the top of his game figure. One thing sort of on a conceptual level, I think that Putin did was that he was rather successful, I argue, in combining a rather like patriotic, to a certain extent, also nationalist rhetoric with a kind of pragmatic stance in economic terms on the world stage. And Richard Sakwa has coined this term of gray power pragmatism, which I think describes at least some parts of Putin's policies pretty well, of him trying to position Russia in the world, but not as this sort of secondary power, but as an actual great power that is able to talk to, you know, other great powers, and especially the United States on an on one level. So I think that's a really important issue. And if we go into an organization like Nashi, its official date when it was founded, supposedly, it was on 15 April 2005. And they really, I think there's two things we have to distinguish. On the one hand, they are clearly or were clearly a reaction to the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, which created a lot of fear in Russia's elite that something like this could happen in Russia as well, because also especially because you know, you had the revolution in Georgia, in Serbia, and they were really scared of a birch revolution. And at this point, you had these figures like Gleb Pavlovsky, political scientist, but also especially like Vladislav Surkov, who developed this notion of sovereign democracy, but also really emphasized the importance of being able to take the streets in Russia, to be able to control the streets, and to do that with the help of youth, because the driving force in Kiev, of course, had been sort of this young urban group of people. And when you see what happened in Russia in late 2004, 2005, with rising protests from various parts of the population over pension reforms, you had occupation of administrative buildings by members of the National Bolshevik Party, NBP, you know, Edward Limonov's youth organization. And there was really a notion that something had to be done about this. So NASHI was founded in April, and they had their first big appearance in the streets on 15 May 2005, when 60,000 young people gathered in downtown Moscow to commemorate and to celebrate the 60th anniversary of victory in the Great Patriotic War, which again came 1 week after Putin had his famous 2005 Victory Day speech. So it was this moment when there was really this very strong symbol of Victory Day was kind of appropriated in this transgenerational fashion, where these 60,000 youngsters gathered there and met veterans, and there was this entire ritual where veterans were symbolically like passing on the fate of the nation to the younger generation, which, you know, I mean, of course, on the one hand, you can say it's propaganda, and there's definitely there's definitely a clear political agenda behind it. But at the same time, I think it is very powerful, and it is a well chosen symbol to appropriate in a political fashion, because war memory is still very much revered in Russia. It's something not only in Russia, but especially there. It's something that every family has a history with, you know, and everybody still celebrates this. And so it is the symbol that people could really get behind, and is also depoliticized to a certain extent. And this is especially important in a context where a lot of other traditional symbols connected to communism don't really matter anymore today. And just to answer your question about sort of this notion of grassroots versus directed, I mean, there are a lot of, first of all, personal continuities. You see, as I said, Vladislav Surkov. You can, if you read, which is one thing I do in this chapter, if you read Vladislav Surkov's writing on sovereign democracy and you read NASHI's manifesto of 2005 alongside, some of the passages are literally the same. So, I mean, he clearly played an important role in co-writing this, if he wasn't the author himself. This is all rather unclear exactly, you know, how this went. But it is clearly something that was initiated from the top. And you have this figure of also Vasily Yakimenko, who was the founder of NASHI, who had also founded Going Together a few years earlier, which was sort of the predecessor to NASHI. And there are also interviews with him where he talks about how he conducted these focus groups, and he received money from the presidential administration, and he went around to various universities recruiting young people. And I also found this in my interview with NASHI members who told me the same thing. So there was definitely considerable state support. There was also considerable support that such a demonstration could even happen. You know, they blocked off all the streets, for example. But again, at the same time, I think it's important that this is a really well-chosen symbol that actually attracted people. Like, you can have propaganda, but if it doesn't enjoy a certain amount of acceptance and popularity, it's not really going to do anything. And I think in that way, NASHI was rather successful.
You talk about the role of the enemy in terms of finding support for NASHI, and that NASHI organizers often try to mobilize an idea of a foreign enemy or a domestic enemy in order to promote and to drive NASHI attendance to the demonstration, and in general support and filling the ranks of this organization. Would you talk about more about the structure of how exactly NASHI works? What are the sources of propaganda, or what are the sources of information from the leaders of the organization to the members?
So in terms of the sources, you first of all, you had the manifesto, which is still, I think, the most important document. On the other hand, a lot of the information passed through the website. So they had a very active website until last year, basically, but we might talk about that a little later. And on a different level, you had meetings like this big rally in 2005. But at the same time, there were lots of lectures. So they had various lectures, and these kind of went, I think you can say, broadly under two subheadings. So one was really this kind of promise of upward social mobility. That is one very important aspect of Nashe, because one thing that they their rhetoric was very much revolutionary at first. So they said, we are, you know, in favor of a revolution. And they also criticize things like corruption. They criticize ineffective state bureaucrats who only think of their offshore accounts. And there were actually instances, especially in the beginning, when Nashi subdivisions went after corrupt bureaucrats in some cities, which also caused some unhappiness among the Russian elite, with Sergei Mironov famously calling them a pack of wolves that couldn't be controlled. So you had this very popular promise of upward social mobility, this notion that talented young people, also if they were from the provinces, should be able to move up into this new kind of elite, which isn't about connections, but it's about talent, it's about merit. So in that sense, it was also more successful in the provinces than organizations like Molodaya Gvardia, for example, which is United Russia's youth organization, which is much more elitist than Nashi was, because it promised this kind of mobility, and also organized lots of opportunities to attend lectures in management, to attend like leadership courses at universities in Moscow. So that I think is one aspect. The other aspect is very much aimed at maintaining control of the streets, as I already said. So from an early point on, you had lots of lectures and classes on crowd control, like this notion of how to direct the attention of a crowd, how to fight against possible opponents. And that is one of my main arguments in the book, is that that was one of the big problems that Nashi had, because it's vice and its virtue, if you will, because on the one hand, this attracted a broad segment of youth, because you could sort of attract these smart, ambitious young people. But on the other hand, you could also attract these kind of angry, disadvantaged youth. I mean, this is a bit, a bit simplified, of course, but at the same time, I think you always have to simplify a little bit. But there was also always a potential for violence in this organization. And again, it's really difficult to prove any of these cases, because there were various incidents. There was an incident where Garry Kasparov, the opposition leader, was hit over the head with a chessboard, and people said it was Nashi who did it. There was the famous incident of the journalist Oleg Kashin, who has been, or who was, an observer of Nashi since 2005, who was beaten very badly and was in a coma for an extended period of time. And so if nothing else, this kind of connection of Nashi and its leaders with violent elements has contributed to undermining its reputation. And Vasily Yakimenko, the leader, made this even worse, because he made statements in 2005, for example, that if there was a Maidan in Moscow, he would get his friends in like the fan groups of Spartak Moscow and drive them into the Dnieper. So there were these kinds of statements that I think sat well with a kind of more aggressive, probably predominantly male young crowd. But at the same time, it created a lot of internal controversy and contradictions. And just to answer your question about who these enemies were, you did have these, of course, foreign enemies. And first and foremost, it is the United States, where we are also coming full circle to the whole war commemoration issue, because you find in various places in Nazi propaganda, you found this connection between Nazi Germany, which was striving for world dominance, and the Americans, who are trying to create this who are trying to dominate the world today. A second enemy abroad was terrorism, which again was, I guess, a more widely shared, more internationally compatible enemy, if you sort of think of the war on terror that President Bush declared. So in that sense, also Putin, who inscribed himself in this fight against terror, that was something that Nashi took up as well. And then you have the domestic enemies, and there it gets a bit confusing, because you had the opposition movement, which consisted of various people, and you had this notion that Nashi and Putin's Russia were confronted with unusual fascists. That's what they called. There's actually this brochure in 2005 that Nashi printed about unusual fascists. And unusual fascists are not fascists in the sense that, you know, they are neo-Nazis, but it's become such a broad term in Nashi usage that it can basically be applied to anybody. And in general, the term fascist in Russian political discourse is a very broad term. And as we see again in Ukraine now, you know, everybody is called a fascist who is opposed to Russian interests. But again, the disadvantage, of course, of a concept like that is that it is really vague, and it kind of leads to not very reasonable reactions at all times. And again, that was one of the problems that kind of kept resurfacing during the time when Nashi was at its peak.
Very interesting example that you bring up in the book about the Estonian bronze statue. It's a commemoration from World War II. Would you be able to tie this event of this protest against taking down this World War II memorial with the World War II, the role the World War II memory plays in Nasha mindset and Nasha, the fiber of what is Nasha?
Mm-hmm. So these so-called Bronze Knights in April of 2007 happened at a time when Nashi was really at the height of its power. We are not entirely sure how many members it had. They claimed they had about 300,000 supporters at the time and 20,000 so-called commissars. So you see, like, this kind of Soviet symbolism also plays a role there. So these commissars were really the activists in the movement, and the supporters is kind of anybody from who has participated in any of Nashi's activities. So we don't know if that's true. It might have been, as other people say, it was 120,000, but it was a large organization at that time in 2007. And what happened in Estonia was that this bronze soldier, which was a Soviet soldier, which had been standing in downtown Tallinn since 1946. And it was a complex symbol in the sense that in Estonia, the World War II memory is not unproblematic either, right? Because you have the issue of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, you have the fact that both Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union occupied and reoccupied Estonia at various times. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, you did have this reemergence of alternative discourses on history, which not all of which saw the Soviet Union as the liberator that the Russians like to see, the Red Army, or not all Russians, of course, but a lot in political discourse, in official political discourse, that's how it's presented. So this conflict had really been heating up and become politicized also within Estonia, especially because Estonia has a sizable Russian-speaking minority, which has been very much disadvantaged since the end of the Soviet Union. So there's a real clear social tension in that country as well. So when Andrus Ansip ran in the elections of 2006, and he promised to remove this bronze soldier in downtown Tallinn, which for many Estonians symbolizes Soviet occupation. So when they announced construction activities at this bronze soldier in April, on the night of the 26th of April, all kinds of rumors started circulating. And even though the government had not declared that it would actually remove the soldier, a lot of ethnic Russians started believing this. And these demonstrations started happening that night, and they became very violent with various offices of Ansip's party were destroyed, for example. And in the clashes, 40 people were injured, and one ethnic Russian was actually killed, Dmitry Ganin. And the interesting thing is that Nashi was actually not very involved in this issue. If you look at their website, for example, there's not a lot of entries about this issue before at the end of April. But they really picked up on, I think, yeah, they realized like what an issue this was, and there was also a lot of emotion within among the members of the organization who were very much upset, also because Andrus Ansip had called the soldiers who were buried there, had called them drunks that had been run over by their own tanks. So it's a really ugly story in general. And Nashe began picketing the Estonian embassy in Moscow and demanded an apology, later issued an ultimatum. And on May 2nd, this really escalated into violence, where they damaged the car of a Swedish diplomat and tried to attack the Estonian ambassador. And throughout this whole time, you see, again, this notion of Russian weakness. Like in a lot of their speeches, in a lot of the meetings, people were talking about how, you know, the government had to do something now against the Estonians, how they had to take sanctions against Estonian goods, how Russia was always going to be weak if it couldn't do anything against this kind of insult to the memory of World War II. And it's really fascinating because you see one of the problems of this World War II commemoration is that it is essentially a Soviet kind of memory. But of course, Russia today is no longer the Soviet Union. So a country like Estonia, which is today part of the European Union, is for a lot of Russians and within this kind of discourse is still part of the Soviet Union. And so in that sense, which is one thing I argue, is that this issue, which is actually a domestic Estonian issue, became this domestic Russian issue. And this notion of having to do something against this act of barbarism, which many people saw the removal of the statue, became this extremely emotional and important issue for Nashi in particular. At the same time, what it actually ended up leading to was that the European Union, which had tried to stay out of this whole issue beforehand, because of the attack on the diplomats, had to become involved. So suddenly all these Western governments started calling on the Russian government to protect the Vienna Convention, which protects diplomats. And there was a phone call from Angela Merkel to Putin. And shortly after, the picket, Nashi's picket, actually ended. So the police in Moscow had tolerated it for almost a week. But very quickly, when this became an embarrassment, I think, to the Russian government, they actually took steps to end it. And it was really a considerable, I mean, I wouldn't say an international diplomatic crisis, you shouldn't exaggerate, but it was an issue, especially because the EU-Russia summit was only 2 weeks after the picket, and it really, the event and the violence in Moscow really overshadowed. So it had real diplomatic costs for the Russian government, and at the same time, very quickly afterwards, or rather about half a year afterwards, Nashi was actually downsized considerably. So this also had to do with Medvedev's arrival in power, who was not a great supporter of Nashi by any means. And the government closed 45 out of 50 of Nashi's offices and cut a lot of the financial support it had given it. So, for example, Nashi Commissars had received free cell phones that they could use, so they no longer had access to that. So it really had serious fallout for both Nashi and the government, and really damaged Nashi's reputation.
I think that this last point you bring up, that with coming of Medvedev, the Nashi support dwindled, and maybe even the ranks grew smaller. I'm wondering, what is the situation with Nashi today, specifically with Putin being back in power and with a lot of unrest internationally, but within an ex-Soviet sphere, specifically speaking about Ukraine, and whether or not you see a potential for a resurgence in the Nashi movement, or maybe a copycat organization also with closer ties to the government, and just in general, how you see an organization like Nashi playing a role in domestic affairs in Russia today.
With Medvedev's arrival in power, certainly Nashi was downsized. But it wasn't the end of the organization. The end of Nashi was declared time and again for about 5 years. But what a lot of analysts, and what I also found in my research, was that it really kind of shifted the emphasis of its activity. So these kinds of rather extreme measures, also measures with a potential for violence, were really radically downsized, and instead it became more active in promoting economic innovation. So it was, in very many ways, it kind of inscribed itself into Medvedev's agenda, at least, you know, in his early years, which was a lot about modernization and innovation, and tried to kind of reposition itself. I think that was partially successful. But at the same time, since June 2013, Nashi has really lost its position, and as far as I know, it's really ceased to exist as such. This was to a certain extent also a result of its success, because, for example, Vasily Yakimenko, its founder, actually moved on to become the head of the Agency for Youth Affairs, which was a newly founded government agency that took over a lot of the activities that organizations like Nashi had done before, and actually also institutionalized them. And at this time, you also had a switch with Vladislav Surkov, who was sort of demoted first and fired. Now he's back, but it's kind of unclear what his position is exactly right now. I mean, he still plays apparently an important role in Ukrainian-Russian relations, and is also on the sanctions list currently. But with sort of his demise and the rise of Vyacheslav Volodin as you know, kind of the main advisor to Putin in the new organization, You also had other organizations becoming more important, and especially Maladaya Gvardia, Young Guard, United Russia's youth organization, is still alive and well and still present in all regions. You also have STAL, which means steel, which was set up in 2009, 2010, which has taken over some of Nash's activities and has also been very controversial. They put up cardboard heads of people like Condoleezza Rice or Saakashvili at one of the summer camps. And so some people say they took over kind of the rougher part, but they haven't really been as active as Nash was before. And just recently, there was the foundation of a new organization called SIT, Web, which was founded by a former Nash commissar, Artur Omarov. And it's really interesting because they also have a very similar platform. So they promote themselves as young, as like a young intelligentsia for Putin. They were also got a lot of TV coverage when they were founded. They drew patriotic graffitis, distribute St. George ribbons, and have also wrote a manifesto, which is all about sharing power with the fathers and becoming this kind of new elite. But I think what is different is that they are a lot more traditional in outlook, because I think with whatever you want to say about Nashe, but like the notion of Russia being a modern country that has to find its place in the world with all the problems it has was really an important issue. And I think it was also aimed at kind of an urban mobile group, whereas SIT is really strongly against gay marriage. They are for traditional religions. They are for Putin. They want to buy Russian products, you know. So it's this, I think, much more traditional kind of like a traditional of a patriotic conservative youth organization than Nashi was. So it's gotten a bit more boring, I think, you know, because, I mean, also with Surkov, whatever you want to think about him, but he was kind of obviously a manipulative character, but also interesting with his, you know, writing activities. And so apparently SIT is supposed to become an important new organization, but at the same time, they're also much more focused on the arts. So like they want to promote, you know, patriotic art and they do fashion shows in Crimea, for example. So, and I think this is also an understanding and a learning process that it's not in the interest of anybody in Russia to have an organization that is primarily known for its violent tendencies. And your question about Ukraine, it's hard to say. I haven't heard or read much about explicit activities of Russian youth organizations. And as I said, there were these fashion shows that SIT organized in Crimea, and there seems to be some activity there. And another thing that I read about was that in this summer camp that Nashi has organized for the past 10 years and is now actually organized by the Agency for Youth Affairs at Lake Seliger, there was some Shirinovsky appeared there and called on young people to go to the Donbass and you know, take up arms. But I don't think it's as systematic as it was in 2005. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that it is a very different situation, because, I mean, now with this kind of, you know, whatever is going on in eastern Ukraine right now, and it's hard to say how, to what extent Russia is exactly involved, but it's not a situation where 10,000 or 1,000 young people dressed in patriotic jerseys are really going to make a difference. I think it's in terms of the techniques of trying to keep Ukraine under Russian control, or at least destabilizing it. It's a very different playing field, and in a way, it's also become much scarier and much more serious. Because, I mean, what Nashi did in 2005 compared to what's going on right now, I mean, they may have used warlike rhetoric in order to mobilize youth, but it wasn't a war like we're seeing right now.
So it'll be a two-part question. The first question, how you feel about the impact of youth in Russia and whether or not they're generally mobilizing in the country in support or against Putin, because there's been a lot of opposition, there's been a lot of support. And the second question is what you're working on next, your next project, and how you see that relating to your current one, or if it's something completely different.
In terms of how youth is mobilizing for or against Russia, I mean, it's hard to say, because my impression, I mean, there are a lot of different activities obviously going on. There's a lot of different organizations in Russia. And I believe that youth organizations probably should actually get more state support in Russia. I don't think that's important to me to say, because I don't think that's beyond that's very controversial. Because if you look at how NGOs in Russia work, you know, how little money they have, and it's still a lot of enthusiastic people who work, they should get more state support. And if you look at these programs that were passed by the Russian government in the last 15 years for like the patriotic education, you have now for the program from 2011 to 2015 contains $25 million. So, I mean, that's nothing if you compare that to other countries. And from what I hear from colleagues, they do get some of that money. So like a lot of historical research that's being done in Russia, also by organizations like Memorial, for example, that is at times being funded through this money, and especially them going to schools and stuff like that. So that is not a bad thing per se. In terms of whether my impression is that it has sort of being active in NGOs still has a bad name in Russia, and if you look at Nashi, considered itself and was sold as a non-governmental organization as well. But at the same time, if you look at the idea of like what these organizations are supposed to do, they are considered to be partners of the state rather than independent actors. So in that sense, my impression is that youth are sort of have, especially after Bolotnaya, after this kind of movement ended again, there's a lot of inactivity again, even though there's obviously a lot going on social networks and people are doing a lot. But in terms of sort of, I don't see a mass movement, a mass youth movement like Nashi was, or also like the National Bolshevik Party was at the time, emerging or in existence right now. And in terms of how they see Putin, I mean, I think there's definitely a lot of support for him, even though some of that might be exaggerated, and I'm not sure if it's 80 or 90%, you know. But I do think that Putin is popular, because a lot of people who are in their 20s or early 30s, they see these past 14 years as a relatively stable and good time, even if not everything is great. But we'll see how that develops with kind of this increasing isolation that Putin seems to be willing to take into account for the kind of like power projection of Russia abroad. We'll see. I'm working right now on a book, which is actually my dissertation on hero cities in the Soviet Union. So, and it actually ties kind of neatly into this project, because one thing that I found very striking when I read a lot of these documents on war memory is to what extent they really recycle notions from the Brezhnev era, from the 60s and 70s, which is really the time when war memory was sort of consolidated and also canonized to a certain extent. And you find, if you read some of Putin's speeches, you can basically replace Soviet Union with Russia, and some of them are verbatim the same. And I found that really fascinating. So I decided to go back to the source, so to speak, and I'm actually working on a book right now on the importance of commemorative culture in hero cities in the 60s and 70s. And I've been, for the last couple of years, I've been conducting research in Moscow and in Tula and Novorossiysk. So I've been trying to really get the perspective of these rather provincial cities, take that into account, because I think that's important rather than only staying in Moscow and judging the rest of the country from the capital.
Ivo, thank you so much for joining us today and talking about your book.
Thank you so much. It was a great opportunity. Thank you.
That was Ivo Meinson talking about youth politics in Russia. So please join us again next time on New Books Network and Russian and Eurasian Studies. Again, I'm your host, Philip Felgach, and thank you for tuning in.